Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you a conversation with a Synod Father as the Synod for Africa, which focuses on reconciliation, justice, and peace, is about to begin. And stepping back four centuries, I'd like to bring you the story of a saintly woman condemned by the church she loved and sought to serve. Her name, Mary Ward. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As over 200 bishops, as well as other participants from across Africa, are making their way to Rome for a three-week meeting focusing on this continent, I thought I'd find out more about this event, referred to here in the Vatican as Synod for Africa. So I went up the hill from the Vatican to the Mother House of the Society for African Missions to speak to one of the Synod Fathers, who also happens to be Superior General of his order. His name is Kieran O'Reilly. Let's listen to what he told me. You're a Synod Father, beyond being a Superior General of your order, at this Synod for Africa, which focuses on reconciliation, justice and peace. 15 years from the previous such meeting, which also focused on Africa. Why was this theme chosen, in your opinion?
Well, I suppose if you look at the Instrumentum Laboris, which does kind of...
The Instrumentum Laboris being a working document.
Yes, this is the working document that's produced now by the preparatory committee, if you like, for the Synod. And it becomes the starting point for further discussions in the diocese, among the bishops' conferences, etc. If you look at that document, it tries to assess what has happened in the last 15 years. And I suppose for any of us to see that there has been enormous changes, rapid changes, and Africa has not been left out in these. Unfortunately, many of the issues that we had hoped might not continue to arise in Africa have continued to arise. Wars, civil unrest, interference from outside, economic forces still not, I believe, working to the best interests of Africa or Africans, but rather working for their own interests. And I believe that the church, very mature in its own leadership now, and with many priests and religious, catechists and laity, sees now an important moment, if you like, to reassess again how the church, with the gospel, is going to respond to Africa as it is now.
Reconciliation is difficult anywhere in the world. No, animosity really runs very deep. What paths has the church been engaged in Africa to solve issues connected to this theme?
Well, I suppose when you deal with reconciliation, you have to invariably start off with the reconciliation at the personal level, at the level of ourselves understanding how even in ordinary daily living, either within the family or within the workplace, that there are times when there has to be reconciliation if life is just going to be able to be lived normally. And I think that's a very important thing that the church tries to continually stress, is the need for that reconciliation with our brother. Every celebration we have of the sacraments and everything that surrounds our life of ministry is about reconciling so that we may celebrate more fully. There is another dimension then, of course, that our communities need to be reconciled within. And it also speaks, this document, the Instrumentum Laboris, or the working document for the Synod, about the need for within church, our own church, for reconciliation to exist. Because the reality is that we know that in certain countries, ethnic groups of one group or another within the Catholic Church may have tremendous animosity historically or for some reasons against other groups. So there has to be continual efforts. We are human beings, we are earthen vessels, as St. Paul says, that need continually to strive to go beyond ourselves and not to allow ourselves to be, if you like, enslaved or chained by our refusal to reconcile with our brother. It goes beyond that then, of course, because we're all living in societies, multi-ethnic societies, multicultural societies, where our church has a significant role to play, especially in situations of conflict, in situations where there is no, if you like, attempt at official reconciliation, that sometimes political leaders will use divisions in order to either strengthen their own political power or diminish the power of somebody else. So reconciliation is an enormous task, not only for Africa, obviously, but for all of us everywhere. But I think because of the highlighting of so many conflicts and lack of security situations and civil strife in many countries of Africa, it is a particularly pressing thing at this time.
Getting on to justice, how does the church foster justice in Africa? Has it played a role in mediation across this continent, both at a political level, perhaps among parties in conflict, or again defending and sustaining the cause of the most vulnerable in society?
Well, from my own experience, I think that aside from the Gospels themselves and the carrying of the word with us, one of the best measures or means that we have is the social teaching of the church. And the recent compendium that has come out is an invaluable help that the church gives to local hierarchies, to local Christian communities, to basic Christian communities, to see what we stand for and to be able to understand the reflection and the development of thought over many, if you like, generations that has brought us to our support for the dignity of the human person, the importance of justice issues in all countries, that there is everybody within society is treated specially and significantly as a child of God. And I would say myself that from the conflicts that I'm aware of, the church has played no small part in being a force to resolve them. And over and over, it is very often church people who have suffered the most because they have had the courage to speak out prophetically. They've had the courage to stand up against oppressive rulers. There are courageous bishops who will take up challenges, who don't fear because they know they carry a message that is true, and it's a message that is perhaps, you know, we may say with pride, but supported by our church in a very wide way. And I think that's very important.
For example, in the area of economic justice, globalization, or the environment.
Yeah, to me they are central, because one of the things that is very striking still in Africa is the enormous amount of poverty. And where there is poverty, there is misery, there is lack of education, there's collapse of culture. There's no chance for children to have a future. And one of the things that we as religious institutes have done, we have come together, in fact, 25 years ago here in Europe and in the United States, and we established what we call the Africa-Europe Faith and Justice Network here in Brussels, completely supported by religious institutes who work in Africa, and in Washington, the Africa Faith and Justice Network, with a specific purpose to lobby in the parliament in Strasbourg and Brussels and in Washington concerning issues of economic interest for Africa. Because we have known and we have seen from our own people on the ground that decisions are made in these places that have detrimental effect on the economic life of farmers, maybe pastoralists, people who are involved in the cotton trade, so many of the different economic forces that actually influence economic life on the ground, decisions are made far away from Africa. It's a slow work. It's a work that does not deliver immediate results. But it means that you're present in Brussels, you're presenting the situation, you're fighting against issues that are economically important for the people in the rural areas we work.
Of course, these issues are connected to peace as well. You mentioned the conflicts before. Why is it that it's so difficult to achieve peace in Africa? Why are there so many conflicts? Political instability too deeply rooted in history beyond these socio-economic reasons, no?
Peace, I suppose, well, it's difficult. We know in other parts of the world as well, it is a process that you need to build a culture of peace, or you need actually to have peacemakers, people who devote themselves to seeking out ways and means to get people to be at peace with each other. And that involves, again, one word, education. It involves formation of people to be able to do that work. You ask in Africa, why? Well, Africa is blessed with enormous riches, resources that are probably second to none anywhere else in the world. Under the ground still are enormous wealth for the future. And where there is that kind of wealth, you'll have people who want to misuse it and use it for their own advantage, either politicians, local leaders, or outside forces, international companies, other states that believe it's important for their well-being, with little or no consequence for the Africans from where it is taken or from the countries from which it is taken. So to build peace, well, for us as Christians, it is after all the first gift of the risen Lord, we believe in John's Gospel, peace I give you. So we have to be agents of that peace, but it's a peace that must be based on justice. It cannot be a false kind of peace that it's nice and calm. Because if it's that, then the problem will only root itself and come up somewhere else again. So that's why the journey for justice is an integral part, I believe, of being a peacemaker.
And my thanks there go to Synod Father and Superior General of the Society of African Missions, Father Kieran O'Reilly, for sharing with us this information on the second assembly of the Synod of Bishops for Africa. And if you wish to hear the full version of this interview, go to www.vaticanradio.org and simply click on the Synod for Africa icon. Meanwhile, time to celebrate 400 years since Mary Ward's founding vision. I'll be doing this with the help of Sister Frances Orchard, the Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, as the Roman branch of Mary Ward's Institute has been known since 2003, the other branch maintaining the previous title, Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
This is the story of a saintly woman condemned by the church she loved and sought to serve.
A saintly woman by the name of Mary Ward, who lived at a time when universities were still doubting whether women actually possessed souls. One, an artist of her day, portrayed with a determined, searching, alert expression of the eyes.
She had this firm belief that women were capable of apostolic work within the church. And this went completely contrary to the thinking of the time, particularly the thinking in Rome in the church, who took the view that religious women, or women in general, should either be married or, as they used to say, behind a wall.
Sister Frances Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, recently sat down with me here in our studios and explained the historical backdrop which eventually led to women religious being enclosed behind walls. A situation Mary Ward had no doubts about, it needed redressing.
Many of the problems of the church before the Reformation were to do with loose living in convents and monasteries. The Council of Trent had re-emphasized the requirement of women religious to be enclosed. So the concept of an apostolic congregation of women was something the church had never experienced, couldn't imagine. I often think a bit like with Galileo, of whom Mary Ward was a contemporary. A conceptual leap was required, and that was just too much for the church at that time.
Galileo, like Mary Ward, lived under the Certificate of Urban VIII,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And Gregory the 15th before that. They kind of shared this view that women should, you know, stay in their place, in their convents, behind walls. But she didn't give up, did she?
No, absolutely not, because she was so utterly convinced that this need for an apostolic religious women's congregation came from God. It wasn't just her idea. That she just felt she couldn't give up. She had to continue trying to persuade the church that this was a work that could be done. It was a work that the church needed. And of course, she came from Northern Europe and from England at a time of persecution, where it was the women of the great households who kept the faith alive.
Keeping the faith alive, as Sister Frances says with a hint of emotion in her voice, was what Mary Ward was accustomed to as she grew up in late 16th century England, in her own staunchly Catholic Yorkshire family, and indeed continued doing when she left home.
It was the women in cities such as London, and Mary Ward worked in London with her companions, who would provide the safe houses for the priests, who would prepare the people for the Mass, prepare the children for the sacraments. Without the women, there is, I think, no doubt the Catholic faith might have died out in England, as it did in a place like Sweden, where it was made so difficult for Catholics. But Mary Ward wasn't the only woman. There were similar Catholic women who saw this as their task, ensuring that Catholicism was not destroyed by persecution. She was imprisoned several times in London for harbouring priests, or just because she was known to be, as they would have said in those days, a papist and an influential papist. But she had friends in high places, and she usually got off with a warning. But other sisters were less fortunate. Some of them were imprisoned for much longer periods of time.
Is persecution the reason why she came to Rome and eventually travelled a little bit around Europe, Germany, Prague, Bratislava, Vienna?
You see, her first desire was to be a nun of the strictest enclosed order that she could find. That was the only model of religious life that existed.
And that's where she started, wasn't it?
That's where she started. She started with the Poor Clares, and she was very happy with the Poor Clares, but then became convinced that God was calling her to something else. She went back to London, collected around her a group of similar-minded young women who, because convents didn't exist in England at that time, if they were to serve the church, then they needed to do it, being around, offering open houses, preparing people for the sacraments, conducting spiritual conversation, doing whatever was needed.
A way of living, this, that raised many eyebrows among the male, largely conservative clerics who came across Mary Ward and her companions, deriding them to the extent of dubbing them galloping girls.
I mean, so much so that the Archbishop of Canterbury, George Abbott, said of Mary Ward at one stage,
"She was doing more damage than six Jesuits."
Of course, she was very much inspired by Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits.
Very much inspired by Ignatius of Loyola.
You mentioned earlier how Mary Ward felt that God was calling her to something different. But she had confirmation of this in a vision, no?
What we call her vision of what God was calling to her came to her, interestingly enough, while she was doing her hair one day in front of the mirror. You know, not many religious congregations, I think, are founded by someone who's doing her hair in the morning. But Mary Ward was in lodgings in the Strand, close to St Clement Danes, and doing her hair, and went through an experience whereby she said afterwards, time just disappeared, and she was amazed to find that 2 hours had gone by. But what she heard over and over again, that she was being called to do something that would be to the glory of God. Glory, glory, glory. We call it her glory vision. And it's that vision that happened, we're almost certain, sometime in late 1609, that explains why we are beginning our celebrations of the 400th year of Mary Ward's foundation this year in 2009. Then what she did with her companions, she decided they needed a period of prayer and discernment, so as so often happened when they needed that, they went back across the channel to the Netherlands, to Saint-Omer, where they spent their time in prayer and in penance, trying to find what it was that God wanted for them.
I understood that the work to be done was not in a Carmelite convent, but a thing that would please God far more and give him greater glory than I can say. But I was not told any particulars about what the work was to be or how it was to be done.
And And then 2 years later, in 1611, in a similar interior vision, she heard the words,
"Take same of the society."
Understanding by that the Society of Jesus. By taking the same, it means what we would call the institutum and constitutions and manner of life of the Jesuits. Not to be dependent on the Jesuits, she never wanted that. A separate congregation. What she felt so called to was the focus on the apostolic life. This is what Ignatius was called to, the following of Jesus in whatever was needed, wherever it was needed. I think we would say today to go where the need is greatest. That meant, as with the Jesuits, they went off all over Europe, they went off to Latin America, Francis Xavier went off to India, and that has been the hallmark of the Jesuits, to be totally available to the needs of the church wherever the Pope wants to send them. That's what Mary Ward wanted. She actually said at one time, even to the Turks. Now, in those days, to go to the Turks, of course, meant to go to the infidel, and that would have been completely and utterly impossible for anybody, even the Jesuits, because they wouldn't have survived for a moment. But that was an indication of, if the church asked her to do that, she and her women would be ready to do it. Over time, things developed and the church began to recognise in the 19th century the power of women in the church to do good for the church through education and social work and medical work. And so you get the development of the apostolic religious congregations, but only 300 years after Mary Ward, and one or two other similarly minded women felt called by God to do this. Angela de Merici, Jean de Lestenac, and so on, all contemporaries of Mary Ward. Mary Ward refused to compromise. That, in a sense, was her strength, but also her undoing. She just said, I cannot compromise. This is not my idea. This is what God is asking me to do. But what must have been so difficult for her, because she was a very loyal daughter of the church, to be in this conflict situation, utterly convinced that God was asking this of her, but at the same time the church, on whose behalf she was doing it, saying, absolutely no, women are staying in convents, women cannot govern themselves, and therefore she submitted and she obeyed. What they actually wrote in the famous Bull of Suppression of 1631...
Signed by the Pope.
Signed by the Pope, by Urban VIII, was that because these women are succeeding, therefore they must be completely and utterly suppressed.
Free from the laws of enclosure, they wander about at will, and under the guise of promoting the salvation of souls, have been accustomed to attempt to employ themselves at many other works which are most unsuited to their weak sex and character. We have decreed that such great temerity must be repressed by sharper censure, and that the poisonous growths in the Church of God must be torn up from the roots, lest they spread themselves further. And therefore, after mature consideration, we decree and declare that the presented congregation of women called Jesuitesses is from its beginning null and void. And because indeed they have made progress, we totally and completely suppress and extinguish them, subject them to perpetual abolition, and remove them entirely from the Holy Church of God.
Mary Ward's Institute, which could have numbered as many as 400 women by that date, because it was gaining ground and because the rulers, particularly in southern Germany, were encouraging it. They wanted schools for their daughters. They were putting Mary Ward's sisters under their protection. I think the authorities felt, if we don't repress this now, we're never going to be able to do it. But you see, what Mary Ward was asking for was nothing that the church hadn't already approved. The church had approved the Jesuit Institutum and Constitutions, and in fact not only approved, but encouraged and gave tremendous privileges to enable the Jesuits to do the work. But a woman comes along and asks for the same thing. Shock, horror, no. Women cannot do this work. One cleric actually said in the end,
"They are but women."
To these words, Mary Ward promptly replied,
"Fervour is not placed in feelings, but in a will to do well, which women may have as well as men. There is no such difference between men and women that women may not do great things."
Mary Ward's words may have fallen on deaf ears in her lifetime, but eventually the power of her pioneering courage and charism was recognised. And in 1982, Pope John Paul II, while on an apostolic journey on English soil, publicly paid tribute to her.
"An extraordinary Yorkshire woman, Mary Ward, who became a pioneer of the active unenclosed congregations for women."
The Apostolic Institute, founded by Mary Ward in the early 17th century, was confirmed by the Church in 1877. Under the name of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary. However, only in 909 did Mary Ward receive official recognition as its foundress. In 1978, with the approval of the Society of Jesus, Mary Ward's company was granted the Jesuit Constitutions, for which she had pleaded in 1621. In 2003, the Roman branch of Mary Ward's Institute adopted the full Jesuit constitutions and the title Congregation of Jesus, following the original vision of Mary Ward. Both branches look to Mary Ward as their foundress, and with so much to share, are becoming increasingly associated with each other's apostolic work and interpretation of Mary Ward's charism.
"The true children of this company shall accustom themselves to act not out of fear, but solely from love, because we are called by God to a vocation of love."
Warm thanks there go to the Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, Sister Frances Orchard. She'll be back again at the same time next week to tell us how the followers of Mary Ward are carrying out their apostolic work across the world today. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.com. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.